From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, for the first time, Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is USA Today columnist and White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandis.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. President Donald Trump takes to his favorite platform, that's Twitter, of course, to threaten Iran while his Secretary of State talks about that country in a major speech. The president also wants to bail out American farmers who say they're being hurt from his tariff battles. He also met with a key European official on trade with the European Union. And the president's former lawyer and former friend has been making secret recordings of their past conversations. We'll talk about that and how well or not well the president is holding up in the polls. Well, let's start with Iran. The president actually took to Twitter earlier in the week and actually threatened Iran, and he typed in big capital letters to make it sound rather ominous. He said, "Iran will face the consequences, the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered if it continued to threaten the United States." Tom DeFrank, is the United States going to attack Iran?
There are some around President Trump who secretly wish he would, but I suspect not, Paul. I mean, President Trump has a tendency, and we saw it big time with Korea. He was talking about the North Koreans, and he used language markedly similar to the language he has now used about Iran. He said, if the North Koreans threaten us and don't back off, they will be met with fire and fury, the likes the world has never seen. So he's used, his rhetoric is from the same "don't you dare or you'll suffer the consequences" playbook. And of course, we now know a few months after President Trump issued that apocalyptic warning, he met with Kim Jong-un in Singapore. Now they're kind of, sort of, not exactly, but new best friends. I mean, they've said nice things about each other. So I think this was a calculation to send a genuine message to the Iranians, which is, don't think about being belligerent with us. But I'd be surprised that President Trump would launch a war against the Iranians.
Well, Steve Goldstein, welcome to the program. On Tom's point, he talked about how we've kind of seen this thing before with North Korea. Is it possible that Trump is actually angling for a meeting with the President Rouhani?
I mean, you couldn't rule it out based on past precedent. So, look, we have a year and a half now of seeing how President Trump handles world affairs, and he seems to like the idea of creating a crisis and then resolving said crisis. But there are other actors. And, you know, I wonder how realistic it is to expect that he's going to go around meeting kind of all the pariahs of the world and one by one sort of knock them off with some sort of peace offering. But I did find it interesting in financial markets really did not react very much to this. If they genuinely thought that there was an imminent war between the U.S. and Iran, you would expect oil prices to spike. That didn't happen at all.
Right. So where do we go from here?
Well, that's a great question. I think with Iran, actually, I don't think that Trump and Rouhani are going to soon meet. I think more likely that we have kind of this international situation where it's the other signatories to the Iran disarmament deal, nuclear disarmament deal, who still will be kind of the lead intermediary, and the U.S. will be communicating through them, through the likes of the U.K. and France. So just based on kind of where we are right now, I don't see those two meeting, but we've been proved wrong time and again.
Well, it's hard to make predictions when you're talking about Donald Trump. In the meantime, Tom, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in California a few days ago. He made a speech blasting Iran's leaders. He compared them to the mafia, said the U.S. would actually back any kind of internal effort to overthrow the regime. There are some people in the White House who've made no secret about their desire for regime change, and we've done that in Iran before, way back in 1953, I believe, with Eisenhower. Is that sort of the game that the U.S. is playing here, trying to sort of back an internal revolt or something?
Well, probably so, Paul. And I think anyone who thinks that the United States government hasn't been doing that for years and years and through previous presidents is very naive. I mean, this is what you have an intelligence agency for. So the notion that this is brand new, Trump administration would encourage a regime change in Iran, that's kind of like dog bites man. That's not much news there, because I'm sure we've been trying to do that for quite some time.
Well, moving on, the president, as you know, is waging a very different kind of battle over tariffs, and he is fighting, I think, what can be accurately called a four-front trade war: China, the European Union, and, of course, our neighbors to the north and south, Canada and Mexico. The dynamic for all four is quite different. Let's actually start with China and this issue of American farmers being hurt. The president, Steve, wants to spend something like $12 billion to bail out these farmers who've been hurt by this tariff war with China. $12 billion bailout. What's that all about?
Well, it's about the very real impact that China has levied sanctions against the U.S. In response to those that the U.S. put on China. And that's having a real impact on farmers, and they're making noise about it. It's a big issue on Capitol Hill. And so the $12 billion is very interesting. He's relying on this 1933 law to try to get it done. And it's, you know, it obviously has never been done in the context of a trade war before. But he does have the authority. And I have to say, on a broader issue, you know, any change to the terms of trade will have winners and losers. And in fact, you know, let's say with China joining the WTO some years ago, maybe one of the issues was that there was not enough help given to the people who were directly impacted. So whether you think the tariff battles are wise or not, I think there's a different issue about whether the remedy that they're putting in place is wise or not. And I think actually the remedy makes some sense, even if the underlying policy has not shown and, you know, not borne any fruits as yet.
I suppose one of the problems that these farmers are worried about is they've spent a long time developing these customer ties with China. It takes a long time to find a customer, build a relationship, and they now fear, Tom, that all of that could go bye-bye rather quickly. That's what they're worried about, and kind of putting farmers, as some have said, on the federal dole with these bailouts. Is that really the applicable solution going forward?
Well, I think this is a political solution. Basically, the farmers are upset, and mainly in the Midwest and in places like Wisconsin as well. And so,
and these are places that voted for Donald
and
Trump.
And you could argue that places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan are places that delivered the votes to get him elected president in the first place. They're angry. They're upset. And I believe what happened is the farmers started yelling about this privately to the White House, to Vice President Mike Pence, one of their champions. And I think the president is reacting in a political way in hopes of buying off, so to speak, at least in the short term. And I define short term as the next 3 months until the November midterm congressional elections, to try to buy farmers and others off to get past what could be a difficult environment for Republican senators and House members.
But the value of these trade deals with China, particularly with big commodities like soybeans and hogs and so forth, it's got to be relative to $12 billion. I mean, that money is going to run out pretty quickly compared to what they're expected to make, right?
Yeah, that's true. But another way to think about it is the U.S. runs a deficit of roughly $500 billion with China. So if the tariffs have the impact of improving the terms of trade by, let's say, 10% even, that would vastly, you know, dwarf the cost of the $12 billion subsidy. So I think the real issue is whether the policy itself gets results. That's really what to judge it on. And I think the fact that he's giving welfare, well, first of all, farmers get paid to not grow crops for many years, roughly $25 billion every year. So this isn't a new policy. It's a stepping up of existing policy. Hasn't been used in this particular way. But really, I think the thing to judge is, does the U.S. end up getting better terms of trade with China or not? That's really the important issue here.
The other thing here, real quickly, is that it seems that the real issue with China is the much bigger worry about, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars in cyber theft of intellectual property and things like that. A genuine issue that that I don't hear the president talking all that much about. Why not?
The Chinese are the kings of intellectual property theft around the world, and they are unapologetic about it. And it's curious why the president's not talking about it, because the word is that he's still pretty miffed about the Chinese. He thinks that there's been a lack of progress with North Korea because the Chinese have propped up the North Koreans under the table, so to speak. And so I'm not sure why he doesn't talk about that much.
All right. We're going to talk about the European Union and the president's recent meeting with Jean-Claude Juncker in just a second. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from Washington on the Voice of America. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. For the first time, Steve Goldstein, Washington Bureau Chief for Market Watch, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports and USA Today.
Welcome back. We've been talking about trade and tariffs. We were talking about China a couple of moments ago. Let's actually shift to one of the other big trade battles, and that, of course, is with the European Union. The president met recently with Jean-Claude Juncker, and it seems like they've sort of taken a step back from the vitriol and the anger that's been crossing the Atlantic. Steve, sort of sum up what happened.
Yeah, well, I think step back is absolutely the right terms. What they agreed to do, first of all, is to take down the steel and aluminum tariffs against each other. They haven't announced a date yet for that, but they've said that they'll do that. And really importantly, they've said they won't do any additional tariffs. And really what that means is that Trump will not impose tariffs on autos, which is obviously a huge deal for Europe. He did win a couple of concessions on the margin. It looks like Europe will be buying soybeans, which will help offset the impact from China. There's also a commitment to look into buying some U.S. energy exports as well.
But liquid natural gas.
Right. But what's important here is, for the first time really since March, that the White House stepped back from a trade dispute. Everything else seemed to have been moving in the direction of conflict. And for once, even if this is just a pause, it's one that I think also will be welcome on Capitol Hill, where they've been telling, you know, Republicans in particular, that, hey, look, we do agree that there are issues with China. We don't understand why you're fighting this trade battle with Europe. There just aren't the same issues, even if the U.S. does run a trade deficit there. Tariffs are generally pretty low between U.S. and Europe on most goods and services, and it doesn't really make much sense to be putting the same amount of emphasis there.
In the meantime, another source of tension with Canada. Sum up very briefly, what's the latest with that?
Well, the NAFTA talks are continuing. The U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer this week said that he thought a NAFTA deal could be reached as early as August. That would set things up so that it could be signed from Mexico before there's a change in administration there. So there does appear to be some progress, but it's tough to tell. It's all behind the scenes. But again, that's maybe an area where at least you're seeing slightly more positive rhetoric, even if, you know, we still don't have the results to show.
All right. So no deals yet, but at least the rhetoric has toned down a little bit. All righty.
I mean, it's President Trump really got into it in a personality way with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He really beat him up after Trudeau said, we Canadians, we're polite, we're reasonable, but we don't like to get pushed around, and we're not going to be bullied by the U.S. And Trump reacted with a tweet storm about that, calling Trudeau weak. And I think, while there are a lot of hardliners around President Trump, I think there are also what I would call hardline grown-ups who understand that it's a low percentage game to beat up on your allies. It's one thing to say to NATO they're not paying their fair share, but to call them basically the enemy, and as he called the European Union about a month ago, he called them a foe of America. Well, I think even the conservatives around President Trump, or at least some of the more realistic among them, have been privately saying to President Trump, "Mr. President, let's dial back here on the rhetoric a little bit." And I think he's done that. And how long that lasts, we will see.
Well, again, you never really know when you're talking about Donald Trump. Well, a little bit closer to home, a lot of our global listeners might not know this name, Michael Cohen, but for years he was Donald Trump's personal lawyer, one of his most trusted advisor. I think all of that has come to a screeching halt. Cohen has now turned on his ex-boss and ex-friend. It turns out that he's been making tape recordings of private conversations with the president. And also this week, we found out that Cohen apparently is also ready to tell the FBI, the big law enforcement agency in this country, that then-candidate Trump in June 2016, 2 years ago, knew about this very controversial meeting at Trump Tower between Donald Trump Jr. and the Russians. Now, the president has gone on record on Twitter and denied that. He says, well, I don't care what Cohen says. I don't know anything about this. What do you think about all this,
Tom? Well, I think that's a very dangerous position for the president to be in, because if Michael Cohen knows that President Trump knew about that meeting either before or after, then somebody is lying. And if Michael Cohen is looking to cut himself a deal with prosecutors so that he gets a break on what may well be a considerable time in jail, given if convicted on the many charges he allegedly is going to be accused of having done, it's dangerous. I mean, now there are some who say that maybe the White House or maybe the president's team leaked this information to discredit Cohen, so the federal prosecutors won't want to cut any kind of deals with him because they feel like he's tainted. It's very convoluted. It's very complicated. But the bottom line is, when you have reports that say the president of the United States was told about a meeting with the Russians, notably a Russian woman attorney with ties to Russian intelligence agencies, That's not a promising development. If I'm not a lawyer, but if I were advising the president, I'd say, Mr. President, get off Twitter about this. Don't say anything. Leave this to your lawyers.
Now, Steve, if we find out that the president has been lying about this, we've known that, to be honest here, that he's been dishonest about a lot of things in the past. If it turns out that he's been dishonest about that, is it just another fib, or is it something more ominous than that?
Well, it depends how far the information goes. Look, if it's just that he's lying about this particular meeting, that doesn't make a grand conspiracy, you know, to, you know, overturn the U.S. election. It really depends how, you know, this is one nugget of this seemingly unending issue, and right now it's very interesting noise, but it is just noise. There's certainly no appetite to impeach him in the current Congress, and already Democrats who look likely to take control of the House are saying that, you know, they're going to need something big before they would impeach him. And then, of course, we have to look at the Senate, where even if Democrats take control, it's unlikely to have two-thirds to throw him out of office. So I think really the issue is that the concerns about Russia are going to be, you know, with Trump for the foreseeable future, and they're going to be in the headlines for the foreseeable future, and he's going to have to govern with this sort of constant noise.
Well, let's shift gears here real quickly, Tom. You know, one thing, the U.S. economy is doing quite well, and we're talking about Trump's political issues, but around most of the country, people are looking at their pocketbooks and the fact that they have jobs now. So is there kind of this broad national support for some kind of, you know, oust Trump politically movement? Or are people paying attention like you and I are?
Well, I think most people in the country are not paying a close attention like the three of us are here. I think the whole business of Russians and alleged collusion or alleged obstruction of justice, I mean, most people think that's background noise. I don't mean to denigrate it or downplay it at all, but you're right, Paul. I think when you get 100 miles east or west of the West Coast and East Coast, most people are happy that they've got jobs. We're as close to full employment in this country as we've been for a while. And most people, for the most part, I think are getting a little more money in their pocketbooks. They may be irritated that most of the president's tax cuts have gone back to investors in the way of stock buybacks and dividend increases. But I think there's probably a majority of the American people who believe that their personal situations are somewhat better now than they were a year ago, and that will help President Trump, unless there's something that the average person cannot ignore.
And I'm of the belief, Steve, and tell me your view, is that people, when you get right down to it, vote with their pocketbooks. How are they doing individually? So is all this stuff just noise, as Tom thinks?
Well, it's not just noise. I mean, look, the politically, Trump has been underwater. In other words, there's more people who dislike him than like him for pretty much for his entire presidency. And I do think that the concerns, they are there and they're real, and they are helping to obscure what is absolutely a pretty good U.S. economy. The second quarter GDP numbers just came in above 4%. Job, you know, unemployment rate around 4%. These are excellent numbers. With maybe another president, he would be sky high in the polls with this kind of economy behind him. And instead, he's not. Instead, he's fighting all sorts of things on a daily basis, some of which he's created, probably many, and others which he's not. So perhaps a different way to look at it is he has this incredible economy, and yet he's not incredibly popular. And I think that's the real political thing that he's facing.
It's interesting that Steve, that you brought that up. When unemployment was this low in the late 90s, 4%, Bill Clinton, who had just survived impeachment, his approval rating was about 60%, which is about, depending on the polls, 18, 20 points higher than the president now. So Steve makes a good point, Tom.
Very good point, Paul. I mean, I think there's going to be more headlines, more scandal stuff, more allegations and denials and over the next 3 months. But I think the next real benchmark of whether all of this is really resonating with people will be the November 6th midterm elections. And if it turns out that the Republicans lose the House, then that will be an indication that while maybe a majority of the American people feel better about themselves, and I agree with you on the power of pocketbook issues, if the Republicans were to lose the House, that would be an indicator that people may like some of his policies, but they don't like him. I think there's about a 35% level of people who love President Trump and will stick with him regardless. There's probably the same number of people who just loathe him absolutely, and he can do no right. And in the middle, as often is the case, you've probably got about 25 to 30% of younger voters who have not voted in many elections up to this point, and exactly how they're going to break on this remains to be determined.
All right. We're going to have to end it right there. Our thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Tom DeFrank, he's contributing editor to the National Journal, and Steve Goldstein, he's the Washington Bureau Chief for MarketWatch. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer Vasco Volarich. I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and the White House Bureau Chief for West Wing Reports. Thanks so much for listening.